Good evening, everybody. This morning, Peter gave very excellent instructions on how to practice skillfully with emotions in the context of our formal practice. Tonight, I'm going to talk about emotions in a broader context or in different contexts. Although there will be some overlap, and that's okay too, because it's always good to hear things a few times. But I wanted to expand it a little bit, include kind of our daily life as well. And I want to start with kind of calling our attention to our family of origin. Oh, that, right. And just pointing to the part that that upbringing has played in how we relate to emotions. So we all got an education on emotions from our family of origin. And the question we want to know, or the answer, what we want to know is, what was that education? What did we get taught? Wide range of kind of emotional intelligence or emotional maturity in different families of origin. What did we learn? What was expressed in terms of emotions, or what wasn't expressed? Were they talked about? Were they not talked about? If they were expressed, how were they expressed or not expressed? You know, when we're just little ones and we're just downloading it, we're mainlining it, and it goes in deep. And so I wanted to start there, because knowing ourselves in this way in relationship to emotions is really helpful and really important if we are to be as skillful as possible with them. So just very quickly, sensing into what that education was for you in terms of emotions. And then just checking, can you see that playing out today? My wife is, she'll make fun of me sometimes if I'm acting like my father. She'll say, my father's name was Arthur. She'll say, "Arthur, so nice of you to come and join us. It's nice of you to come and visit." or another one is, my education for emotions was zip, no emotion, right? And I'll get into this more, but emotions and relationality are very, very, very connected. And so sometimes, if my wife and I are walking, and I'll get excited about where we're going, I'll walk ahead a little bit, and she'll go, our word, meaning relational. Like, come be relational with me. So if we know these things, we can practice with them, and they can be light. They don't have to be heavy. So we all have different kind of capacities to inhabit emotions as they arise, given our upbringing, and also, all other various factors of life. Kind of what culture did we grow up in? There's not just one culture in this country, there are hundreds. What culture did we grow up with? Was that a culture that... where there was a lot of emotionality, or was it a culture where there was more kind of deadness around emotions? And given all this, given all these factors, some people kind of do emotions more easily than others. And so good to know, so that we can know where to practice and how to practice with emotions. So just for example, some people are really, really connected to their emotions. So much so that they can have a hard time getting distance from them, and this is why the instructions this morning were so important and helpful, right? How can we connect to them, but without getting overwhelmed by them? And for such a person who's really, really connected to their emotions and just like chews a really deep, worn groove right into them, then that person's going to really need to be on the lookout for what can they do to help themselves from not getting overwhelmed by their emotions. They're going to kind of need to lean into that side of things a bit. And then other people who don't, for various reasons, don't have that kind of emotional intelligence, or their emotions just aren't as available, then for that person, their skillful practice is going to be leaning into them, really trying to inhabit them as much as possible. One other thing that will influence someone's kind of facility around the emotional life is whether they are polarized strongly or not to the masculine or feminine. Now, just to be clear, when I say masculine and feminine, I'm not talking about gender, men or women. It's just some people are polarized strongly to a feminine essence, and some people are polarized strongly to a masculine essence, and some are just a little bit more kind of balanced. Remember, I was talking about the relationality part and its connection to emotions. So when they study the brain, the feminine brain has many, many, many more hemispheric connections than the masculine brain. It's more relational. It's just naturally more relational. And the masculine brain has fewer connections, and therefore it's less relational. So people who are polarized strongly with the feminine essence are going to be naturally more relational and naturally more connected to their emotions, and vice versa for the masculine. So this is just all about helping us understand, like, where do we start this practice with emotions from? Where are we? Where do we stand? How do we inhabit them or not inhabit them? And again, I think it's really helpful in how we move forward. Speaking of emotions and the feminine, let's just say a few words on that. Yeah. So just to say, there's going to be some broad brushstrokes here. So just want to let you know I'm acknowledging that. And, not but, and in the popular culture that we live in, the tendency is for emotions and for the feminine that tends to be so in touch with them, they both get pathologized. So the word hysteria and the word hysterectomy, completely related and connected. They both come from the same root. In this paradigm, emotions and the feminine, and then given what we're doing on this retreat, and nature, for that matter, these are all, I'm suggesting these are all very closely connected. On one level, they're seen as unpredictable, not to be trusted, and therefore must be controlled. And we know about the history of control, right, with emotions, with the feminine. How long ago did women get to vote? And how long ago, not very long ago, when they were still considered property, et cetera, et cetera. All the women in the room know what I'm talking about. And then nature, nature, you know, how much have we controlled nature? So just, can you see the connections here between the emotions and the feminine and the nature and how they're pathologized, controlled, / abused? So I just want to call that up and point to it, especially this week of people speaking up about the climate crisis. It's helpful to know the roots and what we're actually dealing with. Didn't just happen like, poof, oh, there's a climate crisis. There's deep, deep reasons that we find ourselves here at this in this place and time. Speaking of the climate crisis and emotions, until recently, the vast majority of the conversation around the climate crisis has been around kind of proving that it actually exists and then kind of what we need to do to fix it. That's been the kind of the lion's share of the dialogue. The kind of devastating impact of things like mass species extinction, for example, though, and the emotions that can bring up if we really connect with them, has not so much in the public discourse. It's starting to change actually a little bit now that we've kind of got, yes, it's actually happening behind us, then the discourse can shift a little bit. So connecting with, speaking with each other about, and kind of learning how to connect with and be with the emotions that come up around the climate crisis is really an important aspect of how we avoid, like on the one hand, denial or just kind of dissociation, and on the other hand, overwhelm, hopelessness. It's actually connecting with the emotions that come up around it that will help us avoid those two extremes. Because when we connect with emotions around it, we do it, or in the best cases, we do it relationally. We do it with each other, and that helps to keep us away from the extreme of helplessness and overwhelm. And when we connect, obviously, then when we connect with the emotions, what we're feeling around what's happening to the planet, then by definition, we're not in repression or suppression. So as we're here this week, people from around the world are showing up and speaking up. Yeah, I'm sure you all know this about the climate crisis. Then that's good. This is a good start. But if we're to move beyond pointing fingers, we're going to need to find a way to connect with the incredible sadness, just to name one, that comes with the suffering on the scale that's occurring. Peter talked a lot about how we use the body, with emotions as a skillful way to stay away from the extremes of repression and suppression and overwhelm and identification. It's the body that helps us land in the middle, naming them, feeling them in the body. Yeah, that's much of what we were taught this morning. But I want to just explore this caveat a little bit, that while connecting with the emotion in the body is a good general foundation and the kind of the first thing we want to try, and a support for allowing difficult emotions to be present, being in the body with emotions is not always the best thing to do. It's definitely a good template and a good first thing to try, and often is really, really helpful, but it's not always helpful. And that's in the case when there's trauma present. Sometimes when trauma is present, there's been a trauma in our background, that the body at times, or sometimes, depending on the, you know, the level, sometimes to all the time, the body isn't a safe place to put the attention. It's just, there's just too much activity, too much, I can't think of what the trauma language is, but too much activation in the body. When that is present, I'm not going to go into a whole talk about trauma, but just to say when that's present, we need to have other ways of kind of being with difficult emotions. And in general, it's touching them very lightly. It's not a big dive in. It's really called titrating it and learning how to just touch it, know they're there, but then also learning how to move away. Knowing when and how to move away. The Dharma teacher Akinchino talks about four skills a meditator needs if they are to develop this Eightfold Path, the Buddhist teachings. And the first one is to develop some ability to gather and settle the distracted mind. Right, that's what we're doing with the anchor. And the second one is the ability to move closer to experience. That's the interest and the investigation that we've been talking about. And then the third one, the third skill, so this is a skill, all right? This is not less than. The third skill a meditator needs to walk the Eightfold Path is knowing when and how to move away from experience. If you walk this path long enough, it is absolutely certain you will need to use that skill at some point. It's not wrong or bad, it's just so. And then the fourth skill is learning to see life through the three characteristics of change, of unsatisfactoriness, and of not self. So I just wanted to point that out to underscore that it's actually skillful at times to move away from difficult emotions. Just quickly, the RAIN acronym again. So this recognizing, naming them, it's so important to name. As soon as we name something, in that moment, could change the next moment, but in that moment, to some degree, we're not fully identified with it. Yeah, that which is naming it is not it. And then for the A, I want to add one more. So, you know, accept or allow. Sometimes, though, it's a no. No, I don't accept it. I cannot accept this, right? Can we at least acknowledge it? Just acknowledge its presence. It's like just a slightly deeper form of recognize. Yes, I acknowledge your presence. Something about, there's a tiny bit of a yes in that. Not as much as accept or allow, but it's in there just a little bit. So I just wanted to give you that word that maybe in some circumstances that might have a better flavor for you. You know, we give a lot of time to talking about and instructing with difficult emotions, and rightfully so. We get dragged through the mud with difficult emotions, and we don't know how to work with them. It's a lot of suffering that goes on. So yes, rightfully so, we talk a lot about working with difficult emotions, but there are. You know, what we would call skillful emotions, or emotions that lead to happiness, or are in the moment happy making, compassion, gratitude, generosity, joy, contentment, lots of them. And how do we work with those? We can work with those with rain, absolutely, in the same way. There's also a way, and I'll just bring in another piece of the Buddha's teachings here on wise effort. So wise effort is one of the eight path factors of the Eightfold Path. And there are four of them. I won't go into all of them, but one of them, one of the wise efforts is the effort to cultivate wholesome mind states / emotions that have already arisen. So all of a sudden, we find ourselves, and you're just sitting there, and I know you've experienced this. The mind's kind of busy, and all of a sudden, oh, there's some calm. So it's kind of, so what do we do with that? There's a wholesome mind state that has just arisen, it's already arisen. We're not trying to call it up. That's a different wise effort. And what the Buddha said was, connect with it clearly. Clearly know it. Oh, this is calm, just to use this example. This is calm. What does it feel like? What is this? What is calm like in the body? Right? Where do I feel it in the body? Where do I feel it? How does it feel in the mind? So just connecting clearly and closely, you could say intimately, with any wholesome mind state that's arisen is how we support it to strengthen and grow. And neuroscience is saying the exact same thing. So the way to deepen neuro pathways with a particular event that's happening is this, they're saying, is to get really close and intimate with it. Really connect with it as fully as possible. So I just want to say about, we want to work with wholesome emotions when they're present as well. We want to know them clearly and be with them skillfully. Emotions are quite connected to thought. Sometimes they can be separate. Like sometimes there can be emotion present without thought, but often it's quite connected. And an emotion can give rise to a thought can give rise to an emotion. Often they're conjoined. And one way, just and this is really helpful for our formal practice, and non-formal as well, but we tend to notice it more in our formal practice, and that is when we have looping thoughts, like you're going over that argument you had with someone, you know, if you're meditating and you notice the same kind of looping thought, you know, like after three times or so, these stories that just loop. Once you notice that happening, what you want to do is kind of pause, pull back and go, whoa, what's happening here? And what's happening in meaning, what emotion is present that I'm not being aware of? Because almost for sure will be an emotion that's kind of, the energy of it is driving that looping thought. So let's say you are having that looping thought about the argument you had with a friend, right? And then you go, whoa, what's happening? And you check, kind of tune in, maybe go to the body, hint, go to the body. Oh, anger. There's anger present. Ah, now we can work with the anger, the ways that Peter was talking about, feeling it in the body, feeling the sensations. And what's so helpful here, we were so kind of habituated and addicted to that looping thought, yeah? Go to the anger, go to say, you know, so let's say we see it's anger, go to, oh, tight belly, you feel the sensations of tightness. There's no looping thoughts in the belly. The body doesn't know how to do that. It's not what the body does. The body does sensations. So it's a really, really helpful way to just cut that story that's looping in the mind, going to the body, no stories in the body. Doesn't do stories, does tightness and warmth and et cetera. Okay, so very, very helpful when we're meditating. Who's noticed looping thoughts? Right? Yeah. So what's happening here? What's the emotion that's not being that I'm not being mindful of? And it's usually quite, once we look at it with that lens, usually we can see it quite quickly and quite clearly. Oh, sadness. Okay, right. Oh, loneliness. Anger, the emotion of anger. I wanted to say a couple words about that. In psychology, anger is considered a secondary emotion. It's not a primary emotion, meaning when anger arises, it's not the first thing that arose. There's something underneath. There's something that arose first that's usually like more tender, more vulnerable. Yeah? So here's an example. Someone cuts you off on the highway, right? What happens? Right? You so-and-so. But if we could look back or if we could slow things down, what happened right when that happened? Right? Intense fear came up just for that split second. And that's so just untenable to us. The anger comes in because anger is, wow, you know, we feel less out of control when we're angry. We can do something about it, damn it, right? It covers over our vulnerability. So just to say, just to know that, just to know when we're angry, there's something more tender and vulnerable under there that we may not be connected with. I think I'll leave it at that. Compassion. Compassion is the natural outcome of coming to terms and in deep relationship with our emotions. When we're able to connect with and allow our emotions to be present and be very intimate with them without repression, without being overwhelmed. When we can land there, we automatically see the suffering and the dysfunction of trying to keep them at bay. It's just, that just dawns. It becomes really clear. And so then when we notice ourselves or others doing that, all the myriad ways that we do that, right? This is the genesis of addiction, right? Of all addictions. This attempt to keep emotions that may be overwhelming at bay. And so when we can see that in ourselves and we can come to terms with that, great compassion arises. When we catch ourselves maybe doing it a little bit, or when we see other people doing it. Because we know where they're at. And we know the arc of practice and trial and effort that's needed to move past the state, the place of pushing them away. Great compassion can arise from that. And then just to say, because, you know, people, all sorts of really maladaptive ways to cover over or keep emotions at bay, right? Also, again, this is the genesis of addictions and just the cause of, you know, lots of really terrible behavior in the world. So even though we can understand it and have compassion for it, it doesn't mean, that doesn't equal, and people often get confused with this, that we don't have good boundaries or take action when needed. So we can have deep compassion over the way someone is acting out. So the word acting out, right? Acting out their emotions. They act them out because they can't see them and hold them, so they act out. So just because we can see clearly kind of the how, the why someone is acting out and have compassion for that and where they're at does not mean that we have to actually be their friend or even be around them or have anything to do with them. Let's keep that at bay. So very important not to mix that up. Compassion does not equal non-action. Did I do that double negative? Yes, that was right. Okay. Is that clear? Okay. So I used the word emotional maturity earlier, and I mean, just to say, I think I alluded to it, but I'm not like the world's expert on emotions. My path has been from not learning anything about emotions to really having to work hard to become facile at all with them. So I'm not, teaching about emotions from the top of the mountain by any means. But the sense of emotional maturity, it defines the person that has, like, they've widened their circle of what they, it's not, I was going to say the word willing, but it's not about will. They've widened their circle of capacity to hold of a full range of emotions, hold them, nurture them, and even use their gifts for the purpose of kindness and connectivity to others. This is emotional maturity. There's no longer a need to repress and suppress. They're actually, the circle is wide enough to hold them all, and again, hold them and use them. Use them for connection, use them for kindness and compassion. Emotional maturity is really an indispensable tool for the Dharma practitioner, because it's both the conduit for deepening practice, absolutely, which is why we give instructions so much, instructions and a whole talk on them. Really learning to work with and be more emotionally mature is the conduit for deepening practice as well as the fruit of the practice. It's both ways. This is John Wellwood, the famous psychologist and Dharma practitioner. Yeah, he died recently. He was a good one. He was really a good one. Taught and wrote a lot about this intersection of, you could say, emotional maturity and the Dharma. So this is from him. If there is one thing I've learned in 30 years as a psychotherapist is this. If you can let your experience happen, it will release its knots and unfold, leading to a deeper, more grounded experience of yourself and others. No matter how painful or scary your feelings appear to be, your willingness to engage with them draws forth your essential strength, leading in a more life-positive direction. So you can even hear some of the teachings here when Peter was talking about we're actually bigger than we think. We can actually hold more than we think we can. So yay and hooray for emotions. Maybe that's the title of this talk. Yay. Yay for emotions. I want to end with... Oh, this is so interesting. I didn't do this on purpose. With a quote from Jennifer Wellwood, who was John Wellwood's wife. And I like this because it talks beautifully about emotions, but also she dovetails it with the like some of the really deeper truths of Dharma truths and how kind of like how they lead to it. So maybe you can hear that in this quote, and then we'll sit quietly. The title of the poem is called Unconditional. Willingness to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning to face my fear, I meet the warrior who lives within. Opening to my loss, I gain the embrace of the universe. Surrendering into emptiness, I find fullness without end. Each condition I flee from pursues me. Each condition I welcome transforms me and becomes itself transformed into its radiant, jewel-like essence. I bow to the one who has made it so, who has crafted this master game. To play it is pure delight. To honor its form, pure devotion. We'll sit quietly for a couple minutes.